This is the Bischoff on Wrestling podcast, featuring former WCW president, WWE Raw general manager, one half of Bischoff Hervey Entertainment, and New York Times bestselling author, Eric Bischoff. Now, here's WrestleZone Radio and 120 Sports' Nick Houseman, and your host, Sports Entertainment's king of controversy, Eric Bischoff.
All right, hello everybody, Eric Bischoff here, Bischoff on Wrestling, once again, number three in a row. This is kind of fun, having a great time, getting my feet wet here in the podcast universe. Let's kick back and get some words of wisdom from Nick Aldis. I'm gonna go back now. You and I have had a chance, and right before you got on the air, I kind of opened up with the fact that, you know, you came when we first were introduced to each other. You know, you kind of came in with a chip on your shoulder and a little bit of an attitude, and I was born with a chip on my shoulder and a little bit of an attitude. So our first interactions were not bad, but it was a little remote.
They were detrimental to my career for sure.
But I'm taking
ownership of that, Eric. You know what I mean? I don't want you to think that I'm
No, believe me, I'm pretty self-aware. I know I'm harder than hell to get along with most of the time. But when we finally got a chance to work together, and what I recall was it was a program that you were involved with Sting, and that's when I saw in you what you described just a little bit earlier, is you really had a desire to find the performance, not just to do a great job in the ring physically, because obviously that is a part of a great performance, but you really wanted to understand the character. You really wanted to kind of capture the emotion that particular program embodied. And that's to me, that's where you really stood out. And I really realized your potential there.
I appreciate that. I still look at that as the high point for me, from a professional and a personal standpoint, because I hold Steve in such high regard, especially because he really spoke up for me when he didn't need to. Before you came to TNA as well, you know, he was almost from the beginning saw something in me and was always encouraging them to give me a shot. And I mean, I remember I was in the British Invasion. This was in 2009, and I remember back then they would send the formats out by email to the talent, you know, the day before the taping, so that they could sort of get familiarized with what was going on. And I remember seeing on the format, I was boarding a plane, and it said, you know, Doug Williams and Rob Terry versus, you know, the Dudleys or whoever. And I remember thinking, that's weird. Like, why is it not me? And I was starting to think, you know, oh God, you know, like, I'm like they're demoting me, you know, I'm going to just be like a manager, or, you know, like, you know how wrestlers are, they're paranoid, you know. Obviously I was 22 at the time, so I was, you know, very immature. And I was like flipping through the pages, and I'm starting to get towards the main event, and I'm going, well, I'm not in the main event, you know. So, and then I get to the main event, and sure enough, there it is. It's me and Sting. And I just, it was just like a 5-minute TV match on Impact or whatever, but
yeah, but still, that's a pretty big damn deal.
I sat there in my seat for like an hour just holding this piece of paper, you know what I mean? I didn't say a word. I just sort of had this, I must have had the dumbest look on my face. If anyone walked past, they must have just thought, like, what's this guy taking?
What a great moment though, right? Oh, that really special.
I just remember sitting there going like this, why, you know, like, what the hell? And Sticks, and you know, I'm sure that Steve had something to do with that, because, you know, I'm looking back at it now, obviously understanding a lot more than I did then. It was really just a match to get Sting back on track, because he had a match with Joe at the pay-per-view. I can't remember what the finish was or whatever, but you know, it was a reset you know, match to sort of get Sting back where he needed to be, and I was more than happy to oblige. And I remember just watching all my favorite Sting matches, you know, like his matches with Flair and his matches with Rick Rude and his match with Hogan, you know, and I was just thinking, I go, okay, I'm going to make sure I go and just give Steve like the best 5 minutes that I can give him, you know what I mean? And I sat down with him, and like Jim Cornette was the agent, and I like Jimmy a lot now, but he did not think very highly of me back then. I came in with this sort of reputation as like Dixie's favorite, you know, Dixie's hire, and like no one really knew where I'd come from and stuff. So it just, I was battling uphill a lot. But so Jim was, you know, Jim, as you know, can be quite abrasive, and he was very sort of short and curt with us, and sat down and we just went, all right, kid, like shut your mouth, and we'll piece this together, and we'll just let you know when we need to plug you in. And then Steve was the one who kind of put Corny in his place and sort of said, actually, Jim, we've already had a bit of a chat, and I really like his ideas. I think I want to do what he suggested. And, you know, that
didn't help. That didn't help anything for you, by the way.
No, absolutely. I'm sure I mean, it didn't.
It probably did in that match, and it probably made you feel great in that particular moment.
It did.
But adding to the baggage that you already, I mean, let's, you know, you're a big, well-built, good-looking guy, and you're young. Right off the bat, 75% of the locker room is going to be uncomfortable with you. Just walking through the door.
And then compound that with the fact that, you know, everyone knew that basically I got seen because the backstory of this, I've told this before, but the Cliff Notes version, that AJ was on the cover of FSM, and it was the first time that FSM is the top UK independent wrestling magazine. And AJ was on the cover, and it was the first time that a TNA guy had been on the cover. They always had WWE guys on the cover, and it was a real indication that TNA was really making its mark in the UK market. And in that same issue, there was like an 8-page feature on me because I had been on TV for Gladiators and we were doing very good numbers. So Dixie saw that magazine and basically called the editor and said, can you put me in touch with this guy? So they did. And that was how I got signed. But obviously, you know, that's great. You know, me capitalizing on an opportunity, but you know, obviously by the time it gets through the, you know, telephone, telegram, telewrestler, it's like, Dixie found this guy in a magazine, you know, like, and she just, you know what I mean? She just, you know, and so it just, I came in with such an uphill battle. Like, honestly, that's probably my biggest achievement in TNA was finally being able to battle against that, you know, and keep my job rather than just be another sort of, oh, this is a Dixie project. But, going back to the angle that Sting and I did in 2013, I do remember working with you on that, and I remember really enjoying getting a chance to actually discuss with you in depth, you know, the vision, you know, and the, because I'm with you, you know, the performance is in the story and the emotion and the characters, because ultimately the business is about moments, and the moments that you remember are not very, very, very rarely are the moments some incredible physical feat. You know, they're normally a culmination of a storyline that includes a huge crowd reaction and this emotion, you know. And so to me, that was how I was always wired. I was always wired that way, to think, what can I do to create that? Or what can we do together to give people that moment, you know, where they hate the villain as much as possible, or they root for the babyface as much as possible, and this moment just gives them everything they want, where they can go like, ah, you know, because wrestling's a release. It's an escape from reality.
It's interesting you say that. You know, we were talking before you came on the air about, you know, the current, you know, the Cruiserweight Classic and my perspective on it. And, you know, one of the things that I try to tell guys now, even now, if I do a clinic or I meet some young guys on the indie scene at an event, you know, I really try to drive home to them that your job isn't really to do a bunch of crazy, you know, as great as the athleticism is, and it's fun to watch, it is spectacular, it's dynamic visually. But your job is to create emotion. And sometimes that emotion can be created with a look, a pause, a smile, a frown. But when you think in terms of telling a story and creating emotion as and making that your primary goal, as opposed to how many backflips you can do, you know, during the course of a match, or what kind of spectacular death-defying or or death-risking, you know, maneuver can you perform, the audience will clap, they'll cheer, they love to see that the same way they love to look at car wrecks.
Right.
But it's your ability to tell a story and make them feel something that makes the difference between people that are really successful in this business and those that are just in the business.
Absolutely. And I think a perfect way to exemplify those sentiments would be to take the careers of Chris Jericho, Eddie Guerrero, Rey Mysterio, three names off the bat. They all had, I'm sure, very, very good deals in WCW, you know, and you should be and are credited with giving them their first opportunities on American television in front of a very big audience on, you know, on a tremendous show with incredible production value. And it was a number one show at that time. However, those guys, in arguably their physical peak, were in WCW, where they were doing tons of high spots, tons of high impact moves, tons of high risk moves. Fast forward to when they got to the WWE, and they that's where they drew money, and that's where they made money, and all three of those guys did that based on the fact that they found characters and a way to connect with the audience on an emotional level. You know, they still had those their incredible athleticism, but until you can connect, you know, you're going to be filler isn't the right word, but you're going to be on the card, not top of the card.
You know, another interesting point, and I'm going to do a horrible job trying to recall, you know, Chris Jericho's comments to me, but about a year and a half ago, Chris Jericho was actually a moderator between Bruce Pritchard and myself at an event where we kind of each talked about our unique perspectives on the NWO and the Monday Night Wars and things like that. And Chris, you know, actually called us because he heard about it and he wanted to be the moderator because he was, you know, he was a part of Nitro and the early success of that, but then went on to become, you know, one of the bigger stars at the time, one of the biggest stars in WWE. So, you know, Chris has a very unique perspective. And Chris was a guy, and Chris and I are very good friends now. We stay in touch. But, you know, Chris and I, you know, we got along, but we not really in WCW. There was always a conflict, and part of that was because, of course, Chris, you know, Chris always had an image of himself, or I should say a goal for himself that was large, which he should as a performer. You should always think of yourself that way and strive to be the biggest and best performer that you can possibly be. And Chris was not short on that characteristic in any way, shape, or form. But Chris will admit, I think, if you talk to him today, that, you know, when he came to WWE, he thought he was ready for prime time. He was convinced he was main event material. And shortly after he got there, he realized how much he still had to learn, right? Because the style, the demand, the emphasis on story and character was so much different in WWE than it was in WCW. And to your point, two different styles. But until you're really there, until you're on that main stage, working with other people who are phenomenal at what they do, you don't really realize just how important storytelling is.
Yeah, I've always looked at it like this, and the Cruiserweight Classic is a great sort of starting point for this discussion. I've seen some of it. You know, I've got quite a lot of the, obviously the Brits in there are all guys who I've known coming up. You know, or helped, in fact, you know, some of them. It's nice to give them, I mean, I'm 29, so I'm not exactly like a grizzled vet, but, you know, I'm giving myself a pat on the back because I'm seeing like Noam Dar and different guys, and I'm going like, well, they're guys that I've spoken up for, you know, and helped along the way. But I do watch it, and yes, to me, I go, it's fine. Like I mildly entertained by it, but I do take issue with the lack of emotion, the lack of selling, the lack of intent to cause harm, you know. But I also understand it's apples and oranges, you know, and I know that it's, I really hate how the wrestling business has become so polarized, in the sense that, you know, no one's allowed to, we do probably over dissect it, but then I think that the people who are qualified to dissect it should, and the people who aren't should shut up. But but you know, I know that, like, for example, Will Ospreay is, you know, he's making a big splash right now, and he had that match with Ricochet in Japan, you know, and Will's young, he's like 23, he's a Brit, and he's, you know, ridiculous talent, he's like a savant, you know, he can just do pretty much anything. And, you know, Vader obviously sort of had said what he said about their match and blah blah blah, and I see both sides of it, but you know, overall, I think that when you see those things, you have to be very careful to not overcompensate. You know, I feel like we've just become so, or say we as the business has become so sensitive to a vocal minority that it's very easy to get into this sort of safe zone of like, well, if we give them a bunch of oh moments, you know, a bunch of high spots and a bunch of things where they can go, this is awesome, and then we'll be okay for tonight. It seems like there's a very short-term mentality applied to a lot of the wrestling that I'm watching at the moment, as opposed
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more.
You know what I mean? Like, there doesn't seem to be... No one seems to have the courage to really... you know, invest in something long term, and some of that is, you know, probably down to viewing habits, you know, certainly not pretending to be an expert on you know, ratings or whatever the system is we go by now, because really at this point ratings are becoming so kind of outdated, I feel like, that we have to look at all these other algorithms and everything else. But I'd be curious to know your take on that, actually, because obviously you were at the forefront of monitoring ratings when it was absolutely vital. So to see it now, it's quite interesting that we have all these new things that we have to sort of use as our barometers, one being, of course, social media. But I have my own opinion on that, and I think that we grossly overemphasize the importance of social media feedback. I think it's very disproportionate, but I'd be curious to know what your thoughts were on that. I know you're interviewing me, so I apologize for asking you.
No, it's fine. I mean, one of the things that we try to do on this show is talk about the business of the wrestling business, as much as we talk about any other aspect of it. So, yeah, I mean, look, I haven't been hands-on as a producer in professional wrestling now for a number of years. So I don't have firsthand knowledge of the advertising industry or the television industry as it relates to wrestling. I'm still in the television industry and produce shows for networks, so I still have my finger on the pulse of that aspect of it, so to speak. But at the end of the day, whether it's ratings or, as you said, you know, there's a variety of algorithms out there, whether it's, you know, DVR and replays, it all comes down to advertising.
Yeah.
It all comes down to money. And at some point, all these various platforms and ways to distribute content, at some point, and we're not there yet, but at some point, they're going to have to mature, and people are going to have to track performance in order to attract advertising. And once those systems shake out and evolve, including television, which I think is, you know, the Nielsen rating system has been archaic for the 25 years that I've been in, 30 years I've been in the television industry. It started out as an outdated model. So at some point, when it all shakes out, we're probably going to find out that, you know, traditional television ratings, yeah, they're probably in some way, shape, or form a thing of the past. But there will be a new matrix that people will be able to judge performance of a show by. But until that time, it's the wild, wild west. Nobody really knows, you know, how much of a return on the advertising dollar they're getting in these new forms of digital distribution.
Yeah.
So it's it's going to be interesting to see, because I think it's we're still in a state of discovery. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's interesting because you're speaking from a producer standpoint, and I look at things more from a talent standpoint, obviously, because that's my limited experience. And it's for me, I'm less active in the business than I was, really out of choice, because to me, the finances aren't right, and so I've been dedicating my time to other things and putting wrestling on the back burner. But looking at it the way the business is right now, the first thing I always say is this is tough for the talent. You know, I remember when the WWE rolled out the network, one of the first things that Mickey and I talked about was, so how are the guys going to discuss their pay now? Everyone's going to have to go on guaranteed money, because it's my understanding, and again, no experience of it directly, but that the guys would have, they'd do a pay-per-view or they would do a house show, and I'm sure house shows are still the same as they were, but they would do a pay-per-view and then they would get their check, and if they felt like they needed to, state their case and ask for a little more, they would do so, and then they would sort of, there was a loose kind of percentage of the house basis that the pay was structured on, but it was very much, they pay you whatever they feel like. And I said, well, how's that going to work now that the pay-per-view, they've decided that their pay-per-view business is not worth pursuing. So they've decided to go with the subscription model, which is, I think, smart in the long term. That's clearly where most visual media is going. And you can see that by the fact that UFC took the model. They got wind of it from WWE's plans and rolled it out first, and they're doing very well with it. But I said, they're going to have to wait now, because I was thinking about how any time I had negotiated my contract with TNA, I was thinking, you're almost going to have to wait till the end of the year, get the annual report, because it's a PLC, and then you're going to have to go through the number of subscribers, then sort of cross-reference that with, the events that you were on and the pay-per-views, and this, and I said, it's a hugely complicated way to then go back and say, I think it's this. And then, of course, by the time you get to that point, it's in the rearview mirror, And I said, this is a very difficult time for talent. And it was interesting because months and months later, Punk left WWE, and I heard him on Cabana's podcast, and he talked about how when they were rolling out the network, that was, big hitters like him and Randy Orton and all these guys were having this conversation with each other, like, what does this mean for us? Like, what do we do about our pay? So it's from a practical standpoint, from the talent, point of view, you're right. It is a very uncertain time, and it's probably not that beneficial for the talent at this point.
No, I wouldn't want to be a young talent, breaking into the industry now. Number one, there's just not a lot of places to work where you could make a lot of money. And exactly. Number two, as you just pointed out so well, the financial model is completely morphed and quite honestly is upside down right now. So it's a tough time to make a living in the sports entertainment business, no doubt about it.
Yeah, I think that, I had to keep harping on this point, but I had this, I did Chael Sonnen's podcast earlier, and we were chatting about this because he's a huge wrestling fan. He actually asked me to say hi, by the way, and we were talking about how the UFC, took a lot of the things from the WWE model, and one of them was the pay structure. It's very similar, in a lot of ways, except the UFC, of course, have very, very strong pay-per-views, and they really took over the pay-per-view business. So the guys in UFC get pay-per-view points, where it's clearly defined what they're going to get based on the buy rate and stuff like that. So in many ways, they've sort of taken the model and done it better. And in many ways, they've really taken, I think they've taken the whole genre and made it better. I joked with Chael that he was the best pro wrestler in 2012.
That's great. Well, listen, Nick, I'm going to have to wrap this up here. I'm sure the guys on the other end are scratching their heads wondering when they're going to get to go out to dinner tonight. So I'm going to let you go. I'd like to invite you back, though. There's a million things I want to talk about that we weren't able to get to, but I just want to let you know how much number one, I've enjoyed just talking to you because it's been a long time since we've had a chance to talk. And number two, I really love getting your insight on the industry as a young man coming up, especially coming over from the UK. And somebody that has a very unique perspective on the business. And I very much appreciate it, Nick.
Likewise, Eric. You know, obviously been a fan of yours for a long time and you know, appreciated getting to work with you and under you for that time. And this has been a lot of fun.
Great. Well, let's talk again soon. And say hello to Mickey for me. And I hope things are going great for both of you.
Absolutely.